Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
7:47 this morning. I'm delighted to say Daniel Harris is with us. Daniel, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Today's the first day that I've noticed. It's weird. Normally it happens last week. As soon as Halloween is over, the transfer gossip for the January transfer window begins just around the same time as the first Christmas lights go up in the shops. And Paul Pogba seems to be the available player at the moment. And these international breaks are always an opportunity for us to just take stock and listen to the gossip coming from the French camp. And it seems more pronounced, the talk from the French camp, than it has been before. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but for the first time, it feels like there's a real possibility that this might happen mid-season as opposed to at the end of the year.
I guess it depends if anyone's got the money for him. If someone did have the money for him, I'm sure United would sell him, because I'm sure they would have sold him this summer, and I'm sure they would have sold him last summer as well. I think that United have now been waiting 4 years to see what they thought they were buying. And Pogba has been waiting 4 years to play in a team that will allow him to do what it is that he wants to do. And the match has never quite worked, and it doesn't look like it's going to work. And it's now the case that when United have a game that they've really got to win, Paul Pogba doesn't play.
Yeah, which was evident at the weekend. When the team came through, you were like, right, this is Solskjaer's best team because he's fighting for his job.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no, I don't think anyone thought that Pogba was going to play at the weekend. He, and I think what's going to happen sooner or later is he'll stop being the first change as well, because at the moment he's generally coming on before Donny van de Beek. And I'm not sure that will carry on for too much longer either, particularly if it starts to look like he's definitely going to leave. I mean, I saw Juventus were talking about maybe signing him. My guess is that he'll still end up going to Paris, and because that would suit him better. He's the kind of player that Paris could do with. They don't have a lot of class in midfield. And it's probably the kind of thing that would suit him quite nicely, being the kind of luxury player in the best team in a not particularly high standard league.
This might not be disconnected from the news that there's a vaccine imminent from Pfizer yesterday, where suddenly banks will lend to other companies on the basis that there will be fans in football stadiums sooner rather than later. That's the economics of this, of a deal the size of Pogba might end up working.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. If clubs think they're going to have money, then they'll feel more inclined to spend it. And that doesn't just apply to clubs that are borrowing money from the bank. It applies to clubs with owners, with people that will put the money in if they think they're going to get the money out in Champions League appearances or Champions League progress and all the rest of it. And so, yeah, I think that if United knew that they were selling Pogba and they knew that there were going to be fans in the ground, then they'd be more inclined to try and set up some deals for the winter as well.
If anybody missed the Didier Deschamps quote, he said that Pogba's in a situation with his club where he can't be happy neither with his playing time nor with his positioning. He's not in his best period. He's had a series of injuries and COVID-19, which has hit him quite hard. He needs to find his rhythm. He then goes on to say that there's no concern when a player is in discomfort in his club. He is happy to play for France. He will tell me about his feelings, and as I know him very well, it will go in a positive direction. That bit about his positioning, Daniel, suggests that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is somewhat to blame for Pogba's dip in form, a good bit to blame, actually, according to Deschamps.
Well, I think the first thing to notice is the absence of the Paul Pogba's dismay at all, everything but his performances. I know Deschamps can't really say that he's not happy with how he's playing, but why can't he say that? Because he's not playing well. And the reason he's not in the team isn't because he's playing really well and the manager has a grudge against him. The manager's given him every opportunity to succeed, and I think he's given him more opportunities to succeed than he's earned. And he's not played well enough to retain the place in the team. And that isn't because the manager doesn't want to pick him. Not picking him is a massive ball ache for the manager. And nonetheless, he still carried on picking him when what he saw on the pitch didn't really justify that. So in terms of the positioning, I think that Pogba has disappointed in every possible position that he could possibly have played in for United. He's also had some decent games, but he's played as a number 10. He's played on the left of a diamond. He's played on the left of a three. He's played in a double pivot. He's played on the right of a three. Where else is there that he could possibly play? I think the problem for Paul Pogba since Bruno Fernandes arrived is that the job of hanging about waiting to do something nice has gone to someone who does it way, way better. Bruno Fernandes' numbers are miles better than Pogba's ever were, and he'll also put in a shift. And those are things that Pogba doesn't quite do. Pogba's a beautiful football player, but sometimes he forgets that he's not just playing, he's competing. And that, I think, is really the main difference between him and Bruno Fernandes. And it's very hard to structure a midfield with Pogba and Bruno Fernandes in it. It's not impossible. United did it after lockdown, but I think looking back now, the main reason that did work after lockdown was that teams weren't that fit. So United looked fitter than other teams in that first period, but also they weren't getting run off the pitch. They weren't getting run off the pitch by teams who were running harder than they were. And then that started to happen against Southampton and West Ham, teams that pressed United on the ball and ran hard. And suddenly that Matic, Pogba, Fernandes midfield didn't work that well anymore. United forced it through and they hung in there to get enough points that they needed to finish third. But to complain about Paul Pogba playing out of position when he's played in literally every position and disappointed in all of them is ludicrous. And I don't know, like Deschamps might just be saying it because obviously he wants to stay on the right side of Paul Pogba because he needs Paul Pogba. Or he might think that it's genuinely the case, in which case I really do not know.
Well, this is what Manchester United want to be out in the ether, isn't it? That they want people to be thinking that Paul Pogba has been screwed over in some way by Manchester United, because if people think that, then they'll probably pay a higher transfer fee next summer.
I'm not sure. Like, generally, you get your lower transfer fees when there's a player who everyone knows you don't really want to use and you don't really want about. So I think that it's probably the case now with Pogba, where United would take something to be able to reinvest in the team, to get him and his wages away so that they can buy someone else. And it's a deal would suit both parties. I'm absolutely sure that Pogba would like to go somewhere, and I'm absolutely sure that United would like to sell him somewhere. And it won't be the 120 million quid or whatever that United would like to get. It will probably be somewhere more like 60 to 80 million quid. And I think if that happened, both sides would accept that it hadn't quite worked and wish each other good luck and get on with their lives.
Who would be buying the players that Manchester United would use the money that they raised from Pogba? Who's responsible for that? Do we know?
I'm pretty sure that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has sign off on the players. I'm sure that it's not just go and get me X and that's it, because most clubs don't work like that. And there's no reason for it to work like that. If you're making a decision worth tens of millions of pounds and over years is going to cost you more than that, then it's reasonable that you would have to make your case to someone else, and there would be other people involved in making the decision, because you would want people doing the research, and you want people to bounce ideas off. So I would say that in terms of who is the player that United need, I'm sure Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has sign off. But in terms of spending the money, I'm sure Ed Woodward has sign off and the Glazers have sign off, because ultimately they're in charge. And much as anyone sensible would love that to not be the case, it's a fact. So I imagine that the transfer department, like Matt Judge and the analytics team and the scouts, are involved in identifying players. And what will probably happen is Ole will say, I need players for this position. And the analytics team and the scouts at the same time will be coming to him saying, we really like this player. And they'll have a look at the data, they'll watch them play, and then they will go to the money men and they'll say, we need a player for this position, and this is our 1-2-3. Do me a deal. And Edward Wood will generally come back and say, I haven't done you a deal for your first touch, but I've done you a deal for your first target. But I've done your deal for this one, and Ole will either say yes or no.
So it functions the way everybody else's transfer departments function, essentially. The one thing that we've kind of learned over the last while is that there is a few people very clever at Liverpool who are responsible for the identification of talent. And as everything is going well there, those people are getting a little bit of pop in the media. We haven't really had that from the Manchester United scouting department before, and I wonder if that might actually help Solskjaer, if there was like a, these are these people, this is what's happening. Or maybe we don't need that, I don't know. I wonder if we had a more open conversation about who those people were at United, Solskjaer, and even just the doubt about, did he sign, did he want Van de Beek? He was his third choice, apparently. Is that good enough? Is his third choice actually also going to be a brilliant player? All those conversations, I think, would if there was a bit more transparency about them, maybe it wouldn't help at all. I don't know.
I see Van de Beek, and I certainly see someone who looks like he could be a brilliant player. But when United signed Aaron Wan-Bissaka, he said they briefed that they'd looked at 17 million fullbacks, the analytics team, and they looked at 17 million fullbacks, and they decided that the one who everyone knew was good, who played in the Premier League, was the one that they signed. I think the thing with Liverpool is they do seem to have a really good team who are doing a really good job of finding good players and finding value. I think what they also have is have the best manager in the world. So you sign a player and Klopp will make it work. So I think there's also that. And when you join Liverpool now, you're coming into a team that's playing really well. The only pressure that is on that player is the pressure that the player puts on themselves to do well. If the player fails, Liverpool is still a brilliant team. And with United, that isn't the case. They're signing players, and the players that arrive are expected to elevate the team significantly. And so they signed Bruno Fernandes, and that happened. He did it. But expecting that of players is difficult, because especially when you've got players who are moving countries, who are adjusting to a new league, who are adjusting to a new life, to then come in and have a significant impact in a difficult league, in a team that isn't quite there yet, is very demanding, and most people cannot do it. So when you come in at Liverpool, you're coming into very different circumstances to when you come in at United. You're not coming to play for the best manager in the world who inspires everyone that comes into his orbit. It's a different kind of thing. So yeah, it's harder to come to play for United than it is to come and play for Liverpool. So Liverpool signed Diogo Jota, and he turns up and he's playing better than he's ever played before in his life. And it's not hard to construct a story as to why that is. He already knows the Premier League. He's already happy in England. He must be, or else he'd have left. And he's not. If Diogo Jota comes in and he fails, what happens? Not that much. So for him to come in into a fully functioning team, all he's really doing, he's got the inspiration of playing for Klopp, playing for Liverpool, and playing for his place.
Yeah.
So that's it. Whereas you come in and you play for United, you've got to come in and you're expected to make the team better. And there's not the same level of confidence and cohesion within the group. So it's a very different thing.
OK. How concerned are you about the fairly constant stories around Mason Greenwood?
Quite concerned, but not extremely concerned. Because if we all think back to when we were 19... I don't know about you, but I think it's probably a fair assumption to make that, I mean, I know I was something of a moron. Without the aggravating features of talent, fame and money. So for Mason Greenwood to be, let's say he is something of a moron, I don't think that is a massive stretch, because as I said, I was, everyone I knew was, we all were. So for him to have some difficulties adjusting to coping with his talent, coping with the money, coping with the fame, coping with the pressure at a time like a time when there's a pandemic on, I'm not staggered by this. And I think the things that he's meant to have done are not dreadful. And I'm sure that United will give him everything he needs to succeed. And if it works out that he doesn't, then he won't. But we saw with Ravel Morrison, like what happened to Ravel Morrison is obviously a tragedy in terms of his personal tragedy and not fulfilling his talent and how that might affect him later in his life when he has a chance to look back. But the things that are bothering Mason Greenwood are not on the same level as the things that were bothering Ravel Morrison. So, and Ravel Morrison still almost made it. So, yeah, I think Mason Greenwood will be okay, but I'm not especially surprised at if the stories we hear about him are true. And I would be more surprised if they ended up properly hampering his career than if they didn't. I think the chances are that we'll see Mason Greenwood go on to be everything that Mason Greenwood should go on to be.
Well, hopefully that's correct. And like, they do have people at the club who can talk to him on his own level, who are a little bit older, who've been through some of the stuff that he's been through. And I don't know if him and Rashford are mates or whatever, but like, they can at least ask him to go and help and say, look, you know, I have experience with this. It's maybe worth, we did want to briefly chat on the international windows here. I think Jack Grealish could be player of the year. He's close enough with, if there was a 10-game stretch now before the voting happens in January, February, where he maintains the form that he's had for the last 3 or 4 weeks, then he's going to start getting a little bit of discussion in that realm. And there is somebody who has had his issues off the field and who took a little bit of time because the weight of the entire city was upon him carrying their football team. To mature, and I don't know, maybe he hasn't actually matured off the pitch. I mean, you know, we don't know yet, but certainly his performances on the pitch suggest this is somebody who's cresting to some kind of peak. What do you make of where Grealish is at the moment? And just briefly about the England team, like, they're good enough to win the Euros. That's what the expectation level should be.
I think that the main difference we're seeing with Jack Grealish last season and this season is John McGinn. Who is also a really, really great player. Not great as in like the greatest of the era, but just someone who, great as in good and effective and all the things you would want a midfield player to be. And funnily enough, every time I watched Villa the season that they got promoted, it was McGinn who stood out, not Grealish. Now you're talking like 5 or 6 times. So, and I know that Grealish was the best player in that division, according to people that watched every game.
That's what the Villa fans say too. McGinn, not Grealish. And then Grealish did something amazing. Like, but look at McGinn did.
That's Grealish. And that's it. It's the McGinn, I know Fergie loves McGinn as well. But just every time I watch McGinn, what McGinn gives you is he gives you energy, he gives you edge, he wins the ball, he passes it really well, he gets forward, he scores goals. And having that taken away from Grealish made Grealish's job much harder, because I think that it sort of probably forced Grealish out to the wing a bit more than he might have been there, because that was what he needed to find the platform to perform. Whereas he's now got a bit more scope, because behind him he's got McGinn. He's also got Konta, who's like Villa's 2 centre-backs playing really well, and they've got a really good platform to play. I still think that, I mean, if we're talking actual player of the year at this point, it would be very difficult to look beyond Harry Kane, who is just an absolute phenomenon. But Grealish, I think Grealish is still, if you look at the England team, you wonder where you might fit Grealish in. But I agree that England could definitely do something in the Euros. I'm not entirely sure I trust Gareth Southgate to find the best way of picking the best 11 from the players that he has. And they do still have concerns in the middle of the defence and at the back of midfield. But going forward, England have the players to absolutely rinse any team, and they have options. They don't just have 3 good attackers, they have 5 or 6 good attackers. And doing something, and no team will look forward to facing England, no defence will look forward to facing England. The question is how they balance the rest of the team. I was just looking at the squad earlier, just before I came in, and I was thinking, and I was trying to kind of put together an 11 that I thought would work. And I don't think it's an 11, because I was kind of thinking, if you could play, say, Reece James at right back, he would give you not quite as good delivery as Trent Alexander-Arnold, but he's a miles better defender. And then you could think about using Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield, where you might have a weakness. And then if you perhaps put Bukayo Saka into midfield as well, and then matched it with some legs, whether it was Declan Rice or Jordan Henderson, you're starting to find the team that could do something, because you've also got Phil Foden to put in there. And you're starting to find the midfield that would be able to outplay a team. Whereas previously with England, with this squad, you look at it and you've got, well, you could cane any team on the counter, but England didn't necessarily have the midfield to outplay the best teams. And they still might not. I mean, it's still hard to see. It's still hard to look past France. Obviously, in international tournaments, in any tournaments, that these eventually will come down to a one-off game where if your good players play well, you can win. But France is still, I think, quite a long way ahead of everyone. And catching them is between now and then is difficult. And you've got Italy, who are improving quite quickly, and Germany still have loads of really good players. Spain are a mess.
That midfield sounds decent, but I don't think it would rinse O'Hara and McCarthy Hendrick triumvirate somehow.
No, that's true. I mean, Ireland also have all of that.
But... Well, we'll see. We'll see on Thursday night. I mean, that does sound like a pretty good team that you've just outlined there. And all of a sudden, I'm a little bit scared about what might happen. Daniel, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us.
No worries. See you again, guys.
It's Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts on... well, that was actually a scary England team that was outlined there. Luckily, they've got no good centre-back, so... you know, what you get with one hand from the sporting gods, they take with the other.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.